What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined with our guest producer, JJ Causeway, Pauseway, JJ Press Pause, Pauseway, JJ B-Day Pauseway. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. As you are listening, folks, we'd like to welcome you to 2023. We are recording one of the last things we'll do in 2022, and we thought, what better way to end the year for us, and what better way to start the year with you than to go to an unsolved mystery, a very deep one that gets very murky very quickly. As a matter of fact, I would say today's episode is a study in extremes, the extremes of financial wealth, the very high reaches of it, and the extremes of brutal crime. On December 13th, as far as people can tell, as far as forensics assures us, 2017, a tragedy struck the Sherman family, a couple living out in Canada. Here are the facts. It's a good life. It's good to be king. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, they're definitely lords, right? At least Barry certainly was a lord of drugs? A drug lord, perhaps?
He was a dance, perhaps?
No. Literally a drug lord, yes.
Okay. Yeah, but not
there may have been
the
some
way,
dance involved, but yeah, mainly
not
drugs.
The way you're thinking. Not a drug lord in the sense of one of these movies or TV shows you might watch. He was the owner of a company that produced generic drugs. So generic versions of all those big name drugs you see all the commercials for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was living with his wife, Honey, who was a philanthropist of great note. They were just living the dream, man.
Yeah. And the idea about Lord of a Dance, I want to get to this because he wasn't just a pharmaceutical drug lord, we're having fun with the term, but he definitely knew how to make money dance. He was as involved with finance, non-related to the pharmaceutical industry, as he was with drugs. He's an engineer, has a keen mind for business. At the height of his fortune, he personally had an estimated, well, it's tough when you talk about billionaires. He had an estimated $3.2 billion in personal net worth in 2017. In Canada, that made him somewhere between the 12th to 15th richest individual in the country. Really makes you wonder about those other 11,
right? Do they have meetings? Do they get together? What are their schedules like? We'll never know. But maybe let's learn a little bit about his background, just so you can get a sense of this person. If you are, if you live in Canada or have spent time in Canada, you almost certainly know the name Barry Sherman, but you definitely know the name of his company.
Yeah, he started a career in pharmaceuticals when his uncle Louis Lloyd Winter's estate let him take over Empire Laboratories, which is the company that his uncle ran. And in 1974, Barry would form his own pharmaceutical company called Apotex. Apotex?
Tomato, tomato.
Yeah, indeed, incorporated. He led this company to greatness, at least, you know, drug greatness. He led them to become the biggest manufacturer of generic drugs in all of Canada. It's kind of a big deal. The company alone employs thousands of folks, and they sell drugs in 115 countries. So while we can't exactly say that he, you know, started from, first base, you know, square one from nothing. He definitely did, you know, do what we have often seen, you know, folks like even what's his name, Ben? We talked about him on Ridiculous History recently.
Donald Trump.
Well, Donald Trump. Well, no, I think he's not this example. It's Getty, who, you know, the younger son of the original, you know, Getty fortune holder. He did take, his father was very stingy. He did take some seed money and then turn it into something of use. So this guy sort of, again, he had a little bit of help, a little bit of push, but he, you know, definitely was a smart fellow who made the most of this opportunity that he was given.
Oh, yeah. And there's an interesting note here, too, because I love that you're pointing this out. So he gets his original spot as a tycoon in this industry due to his uncle, his uncle's passing. His uncle had four kids and they did not get the ability to run Empire Laboratories. They got according to them, they each were promised a 5% stake in the business and they were very angry with Barry Sherman. Right. Yep. We're laying some groundwork. They were very angry when he shut them down in court because he was selling Empire Laboratories, which also further propelled him toward the capital and position he needed to create Apotex. And
it's weird to think about, like, cutting off the family tree in kind of a not great way, Barry.
Little pruning. You know what I mean? Maybe why you don't do business with family, but family discord aside, he was a long time marriage with Honey, which you mentioned earlier, Matt, his spouse, Honey Sherman. They married in 1971 and they had four children of their own, three girls, one boy. And Honey was known in many different ways by many different people. You can find accounts of folks who live in the area who say that she was very rude at the coffee shop or very privileged, but that's what, you know, waking up with $1 billion will do to people sometimes. And then you'll see other people saying that she did tremendous good as a philanthropist. She was very active especially in charities associated with the Jewish community in Canada and abroad. So they were trying to put their money towards some charitable actions. This is not to say that they had no enemies. The people who knew the Shermans were not unanimously members of a Sherman fan club. As a matter of fact, Barry was known for being a bit of a bulldog.
Yeah. As you said, he knew the drug game, the manufacture of them, but mostly the sale of them. He also knew how to put his money to work for him, right? So any profits that he brought in, he could make those sing and dance. But he also really seemed to enjoy taking people to court when he needed to, or when he felt that like there was familiar. Something to gain.
Yeah. Litigious, was he? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, very much so. And it's weird because he was actually, in his day, he was like the most litigious individual in all of Canada. It's another extreme of this larger than life figure. And about, I saw an estimate, might have been from the author, Kevin Donovan, but I saw an estimate that said maybe around half of his courtroom battles were just out of necessity being a generic drug manufacturer. But then another half were just that he was a real hot and cold guy. If he loved you, he loved you. And he was a big fan and he would support you even when his friends told him not to. And if he thought you had wronged him, he would do evil things, very petty things. Like he wins that lawsuit against his four cousins, right, after he sells their father's company. And then when he wins the lawsuit, it's not enough. This is a true story. He goes back to the court and he says, these four people have to pay me $1 million for my troubles. The court later kicks it down to $300,000, but he's already financially ruined them. He just wanted to twist the knife. That's the environment we're moving in. And
that's his family.
That's his family. So, you know, naturally you're this high, you're at this threshold in the upper echelons of business. There's a lot of ruthlessness involved in getting there and maintaining that king of the hill position. So naturally, this guy's going to have rivals. Of course, naturally, there are going to be people who maybe got burned in a lawsuit or feel like he did them dirty in a business deal. And they don't think of him as their best friend. You know, they're not in his MySpace top eight, if MySpace is still around. You'll hear a lot of people say, that's just business. That's just the breaks. That's how the sausage gets made. That's how you succeed in a profit-motivated ecosystem. Until, that is, something goes wrong. In December of 2017, horror struck one of the most powerful families in Canada. Barry and Honey Sherman were murdered. And now, even 5 years later, their deaths remain unsolved, leading more than a few people to speculate there may be a conspiracy afoot. Here's where it gets crazy.
The Shermans were last seen alive on the 13th of September at the headquarters of Apotex, where they were taking a look, giving the once-over and the approval for some design changes to a new house that they were building. Miss Sherman was getting ready to take a trip to Miami a few days later, and Mr. Sherman was going to join her a week later.
And the Shermans, we should just note here, they had built a house earlier. So they're building this new house, right? But they had earlier built a house in the 1980s, and this house they were preparing for sale. So if anyone who's gone through that process, you know that they were basically having to go to the old house pretty frequently, make repairs, or at least oversee repairs and things that were being done to that house. And that happens to be where they head at some point on either December 13th or 14th.
Yeah, and you'll see some conflicting reporting about this this kind of 48 to 72 hour period between December 13th and December 15th. But here is what we know from the official records. All right, like Noel said, December 13th, last time anybody publicly admits to seeing them. Hmm. Like that careful phrasing there. On the 15th, just a few days later, a pair of realtors is giving a tour of this mansion in Toronto. And it's around midday. And as they get to the bottom of the house, they're doing the walkthrough. You know, you're buying a mansion. It's a significant investment. You want to look at the nooks and crannies. So they get toward the bottom of the house to the basement. And then they find the bodies of Barry and Honey Sherman, fully dressed, and they're positioned, we should say, beside their indoor basement swimming pool, semi-seated, side by side, belts tied around their necks, attached to the railing of the indoor pool.
Yeah. And at least I think it was in Barry's case, he was kind of leaned back because that belt was keeping him upright. Mm-hmm. Really messed up. Really, really messed up. But it definitely seems as though they were posed, right?
Yeah, that's where this starts to get a little bit True Detective season one, to be honest with you. So at the times of their deaths, Barry is 75. Honey is 70 years old. She has a bruise on her face. Both bodies have been restrained with coats pulled over their arms. Later autopsies would confirm they died due to strangulation. Although that seems pretty clear at the scene, you got to let forensics do their work, right? and look for all the details that indicate, you know, whether or not something was a suicide. Shout out to Epstein's hyoid bone. Seriously, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Always these little telltale signs. And we've got something along those lines here from the author of The Billionaire Murders, a guy named Kevin Donovan. The body seemed to have been purposefully arranged. This is like True Detective kind of, you know, serial killer, elaborate kind of behavior kind of stuff. The body seemed to have been purposefully arranged in an imitation of two life-size sculptures that existed in the couple's home.
Not far at all from where they were found.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You can look at a photograph of this sculpture. We want to note that poor Leo Sewell is not a suspect. There are a lot of suspects here, just to be honest with you, but Leo's not one. He's just a guy making a living through his art, which is a awesome thing to be able to do, and probably never imagined that he would be involved with something like this, even tangentially.
It's kind of like a found object art sort of, yeah, or like outsider art kind of vibes.
Finster and
I think it's
stuff.
Referred to as junk sculpture. And this dude was active in the 70s. And I mean, they're cool pieces, if not creepy unto themselves, I have to say.
The kids did not like those at all.
Well, they look. I mean, when you look at it with all the whatever pipes and little pieces, it kind of looks like skinned humans, but like in a weird junkyard kind of way. It is, and they're sitting on top of speakers.
Yes, they look
like hi-fi speakers. First of all, as an audiophile, that is not a good place for it. That's going to cause some serious vibrations. You're not going to get the best quality, okay, out of your speakers when you've got these metal, you know, monstrosities sitting on top.
But look at the
TV.
That's
neither here nor there.
That's a 2017 TV, guys. Look at that TV.
Yeah,
it looks like a tube TV. Well, you don't make money by spending a bunch of money on frivolous things. I say as I drink dirt coffee out of like a spaghetti jar from probably 2009. I know what you mean. Like it is disquieting because they are, yeah, they were not popular with the kids. These are life-size figures. Something gives it a crash test dummies vibe to me almost. And you can see how, you know, if you grow up, anybody who's grown up with life-size sculptures or mannequins or stuff like that, you realize how that can creep you out as a kid. And they had apparently in the past, all four of the kids had asked their parents, please put these just somewhere else. If you can't throw them away, just put them somewhere else. But the mother, Honey, liked them so much. She really enjoyed them. So she said, no, it's our house. They're staying here.
Well, and she actually borrowed them or asked to have them from a friend who had them displayed after. Oh, man, I'm sorry, Ben. I can't remember the exact thing from the research, but they, some place that had them displayed closed down, and they were taken by a couple, and then Honey was like, I really like those, I want to put them in my basement, and that's what happened.
Yeah, because she's so big in the world of the arts and charity and philanthropy that organizations want to please her, as do people. So it's kind of a social coup for them to be able to say, I give this gift to you. Anyway, we're harping on these statues because the bodies, when they are found, even if you had never seen the statue before, the bodies, when they're found, are in a very similar position. Two life-size statues, two corpses, arranged as though in homage to the statue, right? And when Kevin Donovan, who is probably the world's foremost expert on this case now, when he is looking into the origin of the sculpture, he's the guy who finds the artist, Leo. He said that everything he looked into about this, from when he was first writing about it at the Toronto Star to when he came out with this book, he just couldn't figure out why they were staged. Pretty confident he is that they were staged that way on purpose. But he said, I don't know what it means, but quote, I can't see how it doesn't mean something. You know what I mean? Just like, again, I'm going to stop with the True Detective references after this, but just like Rust Cole, right? In the very first episode of True Detective Season 1, no spoilers, but what a show. this is unfortunately real life. So we're setting up some of the stuff about the statute. This is one of many unanswered questions here. And if you want to go to the answers, right, then naturally, where do you start? You start with the people who knew the Shermans and the authorities who were put on the case. So we're going to pause for a word from our sponsors, and then let's go right to Toronto PD. Let's see what they have to say.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah. Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, let's jump back in here, and we're still in December 15, 2017, and we're looking at statements from the Toronto Police, and you know, it's really just questions about, did any associates of the Shermans hear from them within that window? Did anyone, you know, have any idea what their plans were in that immediate term? Were they heading back to that house for a specific reason? You know, just any information. And according to the Toronto Police, there was nothing to go on here. There were no leads, according to anybody who knew them. They hadn't seen them for at least 2 days or around 2 days. And when they start looking at the crime scene, you know, with the strange staging of the victims, with those weird statues, you look for signs of entry. Did somebody bust in through a window to gain access to them and kill them? Well, it's a little weird because there are no signs of forced entry, right? Any kind of like brute force trauma to any door or window or anything like that. But there was some weirdness.
Yeah, like I believe it was one of the doors was unlocked, which is something their household staff, yes, folks, they had a staff, their household staff knew, right? They had a door that was typically unlocked for convenience. There was also an open window, but no signs that either had been forced, clearly not a kick door operation. Someone either was let into the home or someone knew which methods of entry would be feasible and would have the lowest likelihood of leaving a trace.
I got two things here, guys. According to the reporting, this is something the Shermans would do often. Like you said, ask the staff to leave a couple of entries open on purpose, or they would do it on purpose just to leave stuff unlocked.
And yeah,
that baffles me.
Is it like some kind of like kinky game or something? I'm sorry. No. I don't mean to be.
I think it's just
alarmist.
A very foreign idea to the three of us in particular that you would ever just leave your house unlocked.
But to instruct them to do it, it's almost like they're rolling the dice a little bit. You know what I mean? I don't know.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you're just going to kind of forget to do it or not worry about it too much, shouldn't the standard protocol just always be just lock the door when you're done? Like if you're leaving, you know?
And maybe this was, this is something that we don't have fully answered. Like, was this a habit that had gone on for years? Right. And this will be an important question. Or was this something that had happened relatively recently as they were transitioning to their new abode? Unclear.
Or did it have something to do with someone who had toured the house recently as a potential buyer?
A little inside job, right? There we go. We're assigning some sophistication now. And this actually, as we'll see, this is not your ordinary crime of opportunity by any means. So the other thing, they had recently installed a lockbox that the staff was using to come and go. So it is reasonable for us to assume that they had some of their people maybe coming in and moving possessions or checking on stuff or, you know.
And again, to show the house. Yeah. So realtor can
to show the house.
Grab the key and show people.
Yeah. And so something weird happens in Toronto. The police, not the band, the Toronto PD, initially, the police were called in, but their schedule was just too massive. And, you know, they're mainly musicians nowadays. But Toronto PD was called in as a replacement. And they initially called this a murder-suicide. The idea being, in their initial statements, that Barry Sherman strangled, asphyxiated his wife of many years, and then did the same to himself. The public was not buying this.
I mean, the belt, you know, is typically a hallmark of suicide, you know, but it also seemed to serve the purpose of kind of posing them as well in this situation.
Yeah, that's part of it. Like if that narrative was true and they just coincidentally ended up in positions very much like those statues, it's one of those things where you would almost have to prove it was a coincidence.
Now, how chilling, though, if it were that and it were Barry that did the posing and then he would have to, like, pose himself that way and then do the thing. But also, you know, you kind of spasm and things happen as you die.
Right.
It'd be hard to maintain that pose post-mortem without someone kind of fixing it up.
Mm-hmm. No matter how good or evil, how socially great or unremarkable a person is, pretty much all go the same way unless they're vaporized instantly. You know, they shiver a little.
That's a fun thought, Ben.
I'm a lot of fun at parties. Yeah. It's the great equalizer.
Everybody goes the same way.
No, but I mean, we're trying not to make this incredibly dark, I guess, but it is a dark subject. And I think we're raising valid points, right? There's just not enough information, but there's a lot of stuff that sticks out, like the cell phone, right?
Yeah. We're talking about the murder-suicide initial thing. Then the police kind of switched gears pretty soon after that because there is additional evidence that they find at the scene. And one of those things is Honey's cell phone that you're talking about that was found in a powder room that, according to associates and friends who knew her, she never used that thing. That wasn't like the place where she goes. And her cell phone's in there. And they believe, at least one of the working theories, is that she fled something or someone and made it to that powder room as possibly an attempt to dial authorities or, you know, dial for help, basically, with her phone. Are we going to talk about this? The other weird thing is a stack of papers that I guess Barry had and his gloves.
Yeah. Lay it on us.
Well, those were found very near the entrance, the side door entrance to the home, where both Honey and Barry would always just kind of go into the house. So it seems as though perhaps he walked into the home and was either immediately confronted by someone or heard something that made him run, like put that stuff down and take off.
Right. Because he's not, like most people, he's not the kind of guy who gets to the door to his house and says, "Oh, let me just drop all my stuff outside." You know what I mean? I can't walk into my house with my gloves. What am I, a farmer? You know, he's not that kind of dude. But yeah, they do take a while to revise their findings based on this evidence. And they come back and they have these series of press statements, and they say, and they're talking to the Toronto Star as well. And they say, we are now treating this case not as a murder-suicide, but as a double homicide. And some of this is informed by professionals who look at the scene, right? We'll get to them in a second. But the Sherman family is a financial powerhouse, right? They have a lot of differences. Money can come between people, but they go past the police. They go and hire their own kind of private investigation team. And they release a statement just before the police press conference where they say, we anticipate the police will reach the same conclusion as our PIs, which is that this is a homicide, that our parents were murdered. And things just get stranger. Public speculation grows. The police are searching for any leads. And at almost every single turn, they found more questions than answers.
All right. So one question that comes to mind first is, why did it take so long for the police to rule the deaths a double homicide? It was a tall order for just about anybody involved from the start, that Barry Sherman would kill his wife and then himself. Also, if Honey had been murdered in a different part of the house, Barry would have had to drag her body down to the, you know, the scene where they were found, this kind of tableau kind of scene. And he was, you know, he was older and lacked the strength to likely be able to do that, let alone the whole posing thing that we talked about a minute ago. So it's pretty unlikely that he would have been able to do that, even part of that. And even less possible once we examine some additional details. There are marks on both of their wrists that indicated that they had possibly been zip tied at some point. So that's super sketchy and really renders that scenario entirely unlikely.
Yeah, I want to point something out here. The home that they were in is roughly 12,000 square feet. 12,000 square feet. That's a huge home. And if you imagine just carrying the weight of the dead weight of a human body, or even, you know, carrying someone who is still alive, who's maybe unconscious or something, down a huge set of stairs and across a really long way to the pool where they were found, it doesn't seem possible.
I may have missed it. Where do we see that there is a belief that she was killed in another part of the house?
The idea that she had the bruise on her neck, on her face, and the location of that cell phone.
Got it.
So there's no like trail
spare bathroom,
blood,
right?
Pretty much like a powder room, like you said, Matt. So for those of us playing along at home, you'll start to notice more and more things point to the possibility of not a crime of passion nor of opportunity, but something premeditated, something planned, which looks more and more like what we could call a professional exercise. And that's...
Would we call
that's
it that?
Deep water.
Professional exercise?
Sure, yeah.
I mean, there. You know, again, I think of movies like Seven and like even like Taxidermia, which is a real weird one where a guy like taxidermies right. himself at the end. Spoiler alert, it's kind of in the name. I keep using this word because this is what they always use in these psychoanalytical kind of like murder movies, the tableau, you know, the scene that was laid out. Another really interesting show, a Spanish show called Epitafios, that is on HBO. It's older, but it's like really good. And it's just like a murder mystery where this murderer is acting out all of these kind of clues in the way he's leaving the body. And again, not trying to liken this to fiction. It's obviously real life and this horrible thing that happened to these people, but you can't help but go there if you're a fan of this kind of true crime fiction stuff.
Right. Yeah. Agreed. I mean, here's the thing. You can sadly already draw a sharp contrast between the way the law treats double homicides of non-billionaires, and double homicides of people who have a lot of political and social and financial heft. It's very clear that the Sherman family's private team was able to put some extra oomph into the investigation. And it's not a ding on the police forces, who are often understaffed, underfunded, and overworked, right? But another voice that changed their opinion was the chief medical examiner for the county. The chief medical examiner heard the initial explanation, a Dr. May Chase. And Dr. Chase went on record saying, if this is a murder-suicide by hanging, it will be the first one recorded in history. Which might sound a little hyperbolic.
Well, but, yeah, can we unpack that a little bit? Meaning, like, that both died from hanging? That would be the criteria there. Yeah, got it.
Because a murder-suicide, you know, well, at least here in the States, it's often going to be firearm-related or firearm-powered. But still, it took your question's great, because it did take 6 weeks before the police switched their conclusion. And again, Kevin Donovan, who has done so much awesome journalism on this, says you can tell that Donovan is a little, at the very least, put diplomatically, confused by some of the initial actions of the Toronto PD. He says, you know, they ignored crucial evidence, video footage from a neighbor's home, which we'll get to in a moment. And then he also notes, which is very surprising to me, you guys, I mean, we're not legally experts. We don't do crime scenes, but he says they didn't collect DNA. They didn't dust for fingerprints in a timely fashion.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's nuts. That is nuts. And it's because they were treating it like a self-inflicted incident at the house, right? If it's a murder-suicide, they don't have to worry about anybody else who may or may not have been in that house at the time. So they don't have to even think about that. And if you're operating that way as a police force for 6 full weeks, you are going to lose a ton of stuff that you could have probably picked on initially.
Yeah, exactly. Because there is a ticking clock, you know? And then we talked about the sculpture, but we got to make one more point too. If this is the work of, you know, a professional or career operator, then why, what gives with the bodies? That's not necessary to accomplish the task. That's something extra, right? That's the ordering guacamole, to be very crass about it. That's upon request. And it's probably more expensive if we're talking about, you know, just to say the quiet part out loud, a paid hit.
Well, and the time spent at a murder scene.
Yes, even more important, right? A professional would be painfully aware of that, right? And they would already have an exit strategy, right? Possibly out of the country if they're smart. And on some level, that means there's a symbolic meaning to the statues and the posing, but we don't know what that's supposed to symbolize. We don't know who that message is supposed to have meaning for. It's like, it's, you know what? It's on the level of a Russian number station. It's something weird, but where is that message supposed to be sent?
Yeah, you gotta have the key to decipher it, you know? Otherwise, what even is it?
Guys, I'm just having a thought, and we should probably say this for the end, but if you're a, let's say, an equally wealthy or almost as wealthy person who wants to have something like this done, and you could easily afford it, you may also have strings to pull in the police department to get them to investigate it as a murder-suicide. Just putting that out there.
It's a very good thing to put out there.
It's also a thing you see. I'm sorry I keep doing this, but it's just kind of where my knowledge of this kind of stuff comes from in crime shows, where there'll be some brass that doesn't want to declare that we've got ourselves a serial killer, or doesn't want to rule it a certain way because of political reasons, or perhaps because of pressure from some direction or another.
Just like Jaws, the novel Jaws, where they're covering up the shark attacks at a seaside town for tourists. It has nothing in common to do with Jaws. As a matter of fact, we can say conclusively, add to the list people who definitely did not do this, the sculptor, Leo Sewell, and every shark.
Definitely.
Of any known species. So there's this other question. When you're talking about powerful forces, Matt, I love that, because it could be an equally powerful person who is holding a grudge, knowing that they can touch people in the law enforcement infrastructure such that things get lost, things get buried, things get Epsteined, but they don't have to live in town. What if this tragedy is somehow related to the pharmaceutical industry? That's one of the first things people started to speculate about, right? Because the pharmaceutical industry overall is a huge business. It is global. It can sometimes act like a state actor. It's just very powerful. And we found a source that we thought you all would enjoy, because we do talk about the importance of knowing the provenance of a source, right? So pharmavoice.com, a little bit of a skewed source, addresses this directly, and they say they dismiss the idea of a plot by big pharma actors entirely. They say, you know, it's a common conspiracy theory. And then they say that there are rumors there was a generic drug manufacturer out of Israel that could have done it, or that the Clinton Foundation ordered the hit because Apotex was sending generic drugs to Puerto Rico, Haiti, and Rwanda. And this guy, again, Kevin Donovan, talk about punishing the honor student. This guy says he continues to get calls today with people either asking him about a potential connection to Big Pharma or kind of telling him or seeming like they know.
Well, but also, like, I mean, I know you're not talking about drug cartels, but if you're talking about bad actors from another country wanting to kind of make an impact or like send a message, you don't do something mega cryptic. You like chop their heads off or something, you know, you leave a calling card.
And maybe, I mean, yeah, like polonium in Russia, right? Or mm-hmm. all those dangerous third story windows. I think in this case that calling card, whatever it is, it again, it's the posing of the bodies, you know, very macabre. But the, I don't know, the main thing that gives any sand to the idea of of a pharmaceutical actor being involved or that somehow motivating the deaths is that Barry had a ton of legal enemies, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I want to give this quote, Ben, that you found from, what is this, Jeffrey Robinson's book? Mm-hmm. Book title, if you want to look it up, is Prescription Games, Money, Ego, and Power Inside the Global Pharmaceutical Industry. And Robinson, the author of this book, actually talked with Barry, and Barry had something very interesting to say.
Oh, you should do it. You should do it.
Oh, okay, sure. According to the author, Barry told him that he was surprised one of his competitors hadn't, quote, knocked him off already, unquote. This is, of course, before his passing.
Hyperbole, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of joking with her, right? Like, I've really gotten over on a bunch of these other companies, so it's weird they haven't taken me out.
Right. You know, and the weirdest thing is a lot of that comes down to intonation, doesn't it? There's a huge difference between saying, I'm surprised they haven't knocked me off already, or I'm surprised they haven't knocked me off already. You know what I mean?
Nice.
Like, it's very small things, but like all of this is rich, fertile soil for speculation, but it's not proof. It's just people saying, hey, we know aspects of the pharmaceutical industry are super shady. Hey, we know this guy went hard in business dealings. But if we're looking for evidence, then we need to look at things like that surveillance video, which you can see online right now. You just can't, it's not super helpful, but I think it's damning when you consider the context.
Yeah. Well, right? why don't we take a break? You go watch that video and then come right back and we'll talk about it.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On-demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
And we're back. Let's describe the video a little bit. It's like Noel, you have one of those cameras, right? You have a front door camera?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got the Ring.
Yeah, so you can see footage from that camera angle, but it's not like it's a stationary camera, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, usually mount them somewhere or, you know, have them, yeah, placed somewhere, kind of innocuous or hidden. But yeah, it's like a wide angle kind of fisheye type lens. So it definitely grabs a good bit of stuff. It's a pretty wide shot.
And this is something to keep in mind. Like, hopefully you were able to watch the video over the break. In this video, keep in mind our friends from more tropical climes. This is Canada. And it's the time of the year when there's snow everywhere. What does snow mean? Footprints, right? There's a residential street that's not like right next to the Sherman estate, but it's very near to the Sherman home. And if you look at this footage, which is police got from someone living in the area, it's security cam footage, not high def or anything like that, of a figure walking down the sidewalk. Some time passes, and what is almost certainly the same figure walks back the way it came. You'll hear this called the walking man footage yeah. sometimes. But police can't even tell it's a man. There's like one thing they know about this figure.
Yeah, they kind of know the height of this person. Somewhere between 5'6 and 5'9.
I would imagine there'd be a formula you could use to see how the lens distortion and like, you know, other stationary objects and all of that and kind of cross-reference and get an accurate representation of that from even kind of crappy surveillance footage.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, it's an estimate, right, of how tall that person is because, y'all, this person has a gait that is very unique. The way they walk is unique. And that's one of the reasons that you can say, oh, this is the same person that went that away and then came back this way.
I wonder what it was. I wonder if it was just like, you know, the keep on trucking guy, you know, from the R. Crumb cartoons or, right. you know, I mean, like a real wide legged kind of walk.
Or if it was like a verbal Kent thing.
Exactly.
From Usual
a
Suspects.
Limp perhaps, yeah. a bit of a saunter. I'm interested.
Well, he wasn't, he definitely wasn't like on some do-si-do energy. He wasn't, you know, skipping along, but a lot of us listening along today would say, well, if I see somebody with a particularly unusual gait, in this kind of climate, it can mean a couple things. It can mean, they are injured. One, it could mean, but if they were injured before. They went wherever they were going. Two, it could just suck to walk in rough weather, right? Maybe they're cold and they're just tired of walking. So what made them turn around, right?
That's a good point.
Maybe their shoe, where their right shoe is broken a little bit.
Yeah, maybe they, here's the other thing. I'm not saying this is true, but maybe they have a concealed weapon. Right? And it would have to be something that was concealed in such a way that it was affecting their gait. You would need to be an expert on a couple of things to be able to tell what someone was carrying by the way they were walking, right? Even people with a lot of experience in spotting, you know, a concealed firearm, they'll be able to tell by the way someone moves or the way their jacket is sitting on
bulging.
Their body.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
They won't be able to guess the specific firearm.
No. Right? Yeah, they might be able to guess the type or the size of object that they're concealing. But no, I mean, I don't know that anything that you could conceal like that would like change your walk in a significant way. There would be some telltale sign.
I guess a shotgun, but that feels really stupid.
That's true.
I saw a Mossberg down a pant leg and I was like, huh, probably wouldn't be able to do that.
Right.
I guess I just don't think of those as the kinds of weapons you conceal unless you're doing some sort of trench coat. Yeah. Or down the pant leg cartoonish kind of thing, you know?
Or you're aware there's a camera.
Right. So you mess up your gait, just like Verbal Kent, spoiler, to get away or to not be identified. Right. That is a very clever idea, Matt. And I like that. And it also explains the big problem with the idea of a concealed weapon. If you are caught, if you run into anybody and you've got a weapon and you can't explain why you have it, where you're going or where you're coming from, right? Then you have immediately escalated the problems involved in your situation. So, okay. So there's a sketchy person. And if, you know, it's very reasonable to say, what if this person, just someone who had to like walk to a neighbor's house, someone who forgot something somewhere and they're like, ah, crap. And they walked out and then they walked back, right? Possibly. Right. But if that's the case, if this is an innocent person, why have they not come forward? Why have they yet to be identified? What gives? Right. I mean, one possibility would be that they were doing something shady that was unrelated and they just didn't want to get caught. You know, like they're sneaking out to party or maybe to like buy drugs or have illicit sexual stuff. So they're not going to come forward in that case. But That's like winning the lottery twice for that to happen, you know?
Yeah. Guys, I want to get back to this concept of the open door and open window.
Yes.
Just a little bit. Because I think the timing of the house sale factors into this in some way. And that lock, like you said, what do they call it? Is it a lockbox? The thing that you put out on the front of a door so a realtor can get the lock?
Yeah, it's just like a little usually come from Master Lock is the company, and it's just got a little window in it. You know, little analog kind of code. Yeah. Some of them are fancier, but I think it's a type of lockbox, very specific purpose to fit around a doorknob.
I think there's something to someone touring the home and unlocking a window while they're on that tour, because that is a really effective way to create an opening for yourself if you're planning to return at some point.
Yeah, Matt, I agree with you, because that is an efficient way that houses get cased. But it also would only be worth that further exposure if someone didn't know the basement was typically unlocked, you know?
Yeah.
They would have to not know that. Or maybe they're super buttoned up and they get the window just as insurance.
As a secondary.
Right. Which you would want redundancy ideally, but like then you have to, I love spinning this out, right? Then you would have to ideally have another person involved, because I'm certain that everybody who toward the house got questioned, right? It's a mansion. It's a mansion in Toronto, which has a crazy cost of living. Even then, the real estate prices were nuts. So it's a very specific demographic that's going into these mansions.
Well, then here it is, Ben. Here's the scenario. Right. Some very wealthy person who could actually purchase that home toured it, maybe with a spouse, with their family, or alone, and they open the window for the professional they hired to enter later.
Right. Because at a certain level, you don't do a lot of stuff yourself. You have a staff of some sort, right? Whether that's cleaning your house or cleaning out your vengeance list.
Right.
It's also anomalous, though, because knowing the weather at that time, why would you have a window open?
I wouldn't.
No. Most people would not, right? So I think for all of us, and probably our fellow listeners, that lack of forced entry is a key sticking point, right? It's a problem with all the scenarios that we try to walk through. So let's go back to our expert, author and journalist Kevin Donovan, who says that this, based on the other research he conducted, this to him indicates that the murderer must have somehow been incredibly familiar with the interior of the home. And not just that, but likely had a pretty sophisticated working knowledge of the Sherman's routine and schedules. And that's kind of why, if you are, you know, that's kind of why some of us put a lot of energy into not having an easily discernible routine, right? Like, other than when we are podcasting or when we know we're getting together to do stuff for Hangout, the three of us don't know where the other ones are. I think it's just a good policy.
Come on.
All right.
Come on.
Now, let's just leave it there.
we do have, guys, look, just everyone, we do some like mutual, I don't know. I think it's just a game of cat and mouse fun tracking each other thing. It's fun. It's like what we do for fun.
Who are you doing like a royal we? Because I
just
I'm
us on this
that.
Show. What?
Okay.
You don't do that?
Yeah, you know, here's a trick though. If you do think that someone is doing some kind of untoward tracking and you need to throw them off for any reason, right? One of the things that you can do very easily is just figure out how much time you need to buy and then take your phone, your cell phone, and put it on mass transit where it'll get stolen and someone else will take it. You could, if you want to involve someone else, put it in like a privately owned car or something, with their consent. It's the only way it's legal.
Yeah. The best thing for me is record like high fidelity television show, with a separate mic, then play that back in a place in your house that, has a television, has the capability to like play that content, and then go do your business. But make sure it sounds of you watching the TV inside the recording.
Yeah, I like that one. It's a little extra work, like our conversation where you and I were very much saying that you got to reheat pizza in the pan. It's just
better. Yeah. Except it's I just put little, it in the oven anyway.
Right. It's a little extra work, but it improves the end result. This conversation just went through a couple of very strange places, so what we're doing is we're endeavoring to think in a very grounded way through the problems, right? Because again, even the police investigation, even the private investigation, just led to more questions so far as we know. Now, at this point, you know, folks, we only do two-part episodes when we feel very strongly about what we need to get to. And this is one of those situations. So we are going to pause here at part one of Who Killed the Shermans. And we're going to return in our very next episode with part two. But in the meantime, we want to know what you think.
That's right. Let us know what you think. You can reach us at Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram.
We have a phone number, 1-833-STDWYTK. When you call in, give yourself a cool nickname, and you've got 3 minutes, say whatever you'd like. Let us know if we can use your name and voice on one of our listener mail episodes, and those are the only rules. If you don't like using your phone to give us a call, why not send us an email? We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.